30th, 1935. Fred Offenhauser and Leo Goosen are at the Indianapolis 500 with the goal of bringing an engine with a brief but impressive history back to the podium. Although they have bore the Offenhauser name for only a short while, the engine had dominated the race under another name for much of the 1920s, until regulation changes in racing and the Great Depression sidelined their business. Today will be a huge test for the team. After suffering troubles in qualifying, Offenhauser driver Kelly Petillo nearly misses out on the race altogether. But against all odds, Petillo takes the checkered flag that day, and in the process, starts a domino effect that would bring Offenhauser back into the spotlight and make it one of the most prestigious names in American motorsport. How did Offenhauser get its start making incredibly reliable racing engines, then remain competitive for nearly 50 years? And what is it about Offie engines that resulted in the most dominant run in motorsports history? Well, today on Pass Gas, we're going to find out. It's the story of Offenhauser engines.
Pass Gas Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about ports.
I love that domino effect when you set dominoes in a row.
Yeah.
And then you press the first one and then they all fall over.
That is pretty. How do they do that?
Yeah.
That's a crazy effect. A domino effect.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Past Gas, everybody. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for joining us. My name is Nolan Sykes. I'm joined by my co-hosts. Across from me this week, it's Max Maddox.
Hey. What's
up, guys? And me, I'm Jason Mraz. Babadeep-dab-doobadeep-dee.
Joe found a fedora right before
yeah.
this shoot.
Oh, yeah, that's here.
My fedora didn't fit over my headphones.
It makes more sense if you wear the trilby. Yeah. That's Joe Weber.
Yo, what are we watching past gas, ladies and gentlemen?
There, that's the only way it stays on my head.
All right, so this week we're
that fedora tips itself.
It's really distracting me, actually.
Mo lady.
Did you guys ever wear trilbies or fedoras unironically?
Never.
Mm-mm. Never. I did buy one my friend's wedding in like 2013 or 14. I was like 21 years old.
That's pretty late to be wearing a fedora.
I went to Kohl's. I spent like $100 on my outfit.
I thought you were going to say that on just a fedora.
Oh, no. It was a terrible look. I had like these $40, like the most uncomfortable dress shoes I've ever worn. Oh, yeah. Matching belt. I had a vest, tie, and that trilby.
Sorry, I cut you off.
Sorry.
We have Max on the pod today. Max is our creative director of the main channel. You probably heard him a million times. He's responsible for all of Donut's success.
And some of our worst ideas, too. I should take credit for all of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Like the blood car?
That one wasn't completely.
Let's talk about blood car.
Yeah.
Can we talk about blood car?
That one
car?
Was not my fault completely.
Yeah. Who is pushing that one?
I didn't even come up with the idea. I came up with an idea to make a catalytic converter that when thieves tried to steal it, pig's blood would come out and fall on them. And then somebody was like, well, what if we just put blood in the car? Yeah. And everyone was like, yeah, let's put blood in the car. That was a unanimous decision by the whole group.
The thing about blood car is that was an idea that we had, I think, bouncing around for like 3 to 5 years at that point. We would jokingly refer to it in pitch meetings like every 6 months. Oh, we got to do blood car. And then the stars aligned. We had that Buick LeSabre ready to go for it.
Let's run it with
and
blood
look, honestly,
instead of
like,
oil.
That, for longtime fans of the channel, for even more recent fans of the channel, like, and myself, like, I feel like that marked kind of like a little bit of the jumping of the shark moment for us. And that's when we kind of realized that we had to reel things back a little bit. We know we went too far. We reference blood car like a lot when it's like, hey, is this too close to blood car?
And for reference, we replaced the oil in a car with literal pig's blood.
Yeah.
For reasons that seemed to make sense at the time.
It was a time, and we learned from it, I think. And I think right now we're in one of our strongest creative periods of the channel. Like today, our PT Cruiser infiltration video just came out. I'm really, really proud of that video. We got, on Friday, the E30 build video. I just watched that last night.
say what you will about Blood Car, it's not the last bodily powered vehicle that you'll see on this channel. Okay. But what we have coming up is a lot more scientific.
It's a really cool idea, and I'm excited for it. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, here we go. Let's talk Offenhauser, a topic I'm very excited to talk about, by the way.
Yeah.
The Offenhauser engine, or Offie, owes its existence and legacy to three men. Their namesake, Frederick H. Offenhauser Jr., was born on February 11th, 1888. Los Angeles, California. Fred took an interest in machines at an early age, much to the dismay of his parents, who were set on getting their son an education. Fred's desire to work with machines was so strong that when he was in the seventh grade, he walked out of a class and down the street to a local ironworks foundry and persuaded them to give him a job.
That's what happens when you name your baby an adult name. They get a job at 11 years old. Hey, Fred. And he's like a 10-year-old.
A lot of kids have some really serious names right now, by the way.
Oh, dude, let me tell you. As someone who is trying to name his kid, there is a very folksy push in the new parent community right now. There's a lot of like, Henry, I love the name Henry. Mm-hmm. That's a 90-year-old man name.
I am part of this push. I like an older school name. I am tired. Dude, you're Braylins. You're
Braylin?
I don't know.
What? That was your example?
Of like a new school name?
Well, you know what one of the fastest growing names is right now? Chosen with a Z.
Whoa.
Is one of the fastest growing male names right now.
Okay. See, I'm not about, I like an old school name. Yeah. I like an old man name.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. Anyway.
But there is a line.
Sure. Like
you
Baby
can't be
Harold.
Too twee.
No, but you can give him a nickname though.
Yeah. I guess Baby Freddy. That's
cute. Little Freddy. Yeah. Okay. So Fred came home that afternoon and delivered the news that he had got a job, and his parents were furious. But Fred was adamant about keeping the job, so his father worked out an arrangement with the foundry management to allow Fred to work there each day after school.
They just let this kid have a job?
Dude, he's 13 and 18, born in 1888, so yeah, it's like 1901. Yeah, of course they did. They weren't labor laws yet.
No.
That's, this is still like Upton Sinclair times where kids are working in the meat factories, right? Getting squished in big machines.
Might as well work with making engines or something.
Yeah, getting squished between two big ass trucks.
So Fred held the job for several years, and his late teens found work as an apprentice machinist for the Pacific Electric Railway. By 1913, Fred was in his early 20s. He had completed his apprenticeship and secured his first job as a junior machinist at Miller Production Company. It was there where he met Offie's second contributor, one Harry Miller. Harold Arminius Miller was born on December 9th, 1875 in Minimony, Wisconsin.
Menominee. I love it. It's so cute, though.
Menominee.
The way you said it. I'm from Milwaukee, which is on Lake Michigan, the east side. This is on the Mississippi River.
Oh,
which defines the west coast of Wisconsin.
I see.
Yeah. This is actually where Gus Johnson is from.
Oh, Menominee. Yeah. Like Fred, Harold Arminius Miller showed interest in machines throughout his childhood. And as a young adult, Harry got his first job with the Yale Automotive Company in Toledo, Ohio. Then he moved to Lansing, Michigan for a short while later to work as a racing mechanic with Oldsmobile in the early 1900s.
This is before GM bought them.
Yes.
So he's in his like early to mid-20s at this point, and he's already had several jobs in the automotive industry.
Yeah. He probably has like six children already, too.
After a poor showing from the Oldsmobile team in 1906, though, Harry packed his bags and set out for Los Angeles. A short while later, he opened the Miller Production Company, which produced carburetors. Despite having no formal training in engineering, Harry was impressively well-versed in the field. After founding the company, he designed and built a line of lightweight aluminum carbs that became very popular in the American racing scene. Racing at the time was exploding in popularity thanks to new speedways in Indianapolis and LA, the advent of high-profile cup series like the Vanderbilt Cup, and prestigious races like the 400-plus-mile American Grand Prize that even managed to attract the predecessor series to Formula One. And Harry's timing couldn't have been better. Miller also designed engines in his spare time, including small single-cylinder engines for bicycles and a four-cylinder marine engine for his boat. When Fred arrived to work for him in 1913, his expertise in casting and machine work proved to be invaluable to making Harry's designs come to life. Harry was impressed with Fred from the outset, and he quickly rose to the ranks of the company and became shop foreman. Just as the company seemed primed to enter engine building, their work was put on pause when the U.S. entered World War I in 1917. The shop temporarily converted to producing parts for aircraft engines, and a makeshift plant was even opened in New York City for the cause. After the war, some American servicemen brought advanced dual overhead cam European racing engines, such as those made by Peugeot, back to the States. The engines proved to be highly competitive.
But so this is something that we saw in World War II as well, but it was like lightweight British roadsters that became Corvette.
Thunderbird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, pretty common thing.
So they go and experience other stuff in Europe, they come back, and they have a new...
Like healthcare. And good cheese.
Yeah, dude.
What was like, Peugeot doing back then? They were zipping around, doing a little racy stuff, different than what we were doing in the States?
Probably making stuff for the war. Obviously, making stuff for the war.
Obviously.
Obviously, dude. Widowy making stuff for the war.
So these Peugeot engines proved to be highly competitive, but thousands of miles away from their original manufacturers, these U.S.-based racing teams needed suppliers to build bespoke parts to repair them. The racing teams based near L.A. turned to the combined expertise of Harry and Fred, who not only built replacement parts, but even developed improved components such as lightweight alloy pistons. It was around this time the third and final contributor to the Offey engines arrived, one Leo Goosen. Born on June 7th, 1892, Leo was a driven and highly intelligent draftsman and designer who had gotten a job helping draft blueprints for Buick at age 16.
Wow.
Leo also took engineering and math classes at night to sharpen his skills and quickly developed a reputation at Buick for his expert-level stress calculations and for his ability to perfect concept drawings. After a battle with tuberculosis that kept him out of World War I, Leo relocated to L.A. and applied for a job at Miller Production Company with a recommendation letter from Walter P. Chrysler himself and was officially hired in August of 1919. Together, though, Fred, Harry, and Leo would prove to be lightning in a bottle, and their innovations would forever shape American racing. Dude, this is like a dream team of all these crazy, smart, young, driven guys coming together. And they're gonna change some things.
I feel like the modern equivalent is kids getting into like crypto gambling now.
Meet the young entrepreneur who's interested in cryptocurrency.
I'm gonna work really hard for 3 years so I can retire at age 20 and live in Dubai.
Yeah.
More of that story right after this. We gotta pay the bills. The trio's first racing design came in the form of dual overhead conversions for the Ford Model T, which saw popularity in local dirt track racing. Dude.
That's pretty cool. So a Model T would have had what, like a flathead?
Yes.
And how does that differ from a dual overhead cam? Single cam?
This is interesting because with the Ford Model T's engine, it's a flathead design. So the valves are sitting basically next to the cylinder there. So when the piston is coming up... traveling, the valves are also coming out of that pretty much in that same plane. So it's like a lawnmower engine. If you've ever taken one of those apart, it's like, the cylinder and the piston and everything else, the valves are all in the cylinder block there. With this, with an overhead design, now the valves are above the combustion chamber, much like pretty much every engine now.
Yeah. There's a header.
Like that. Well, no, it's like there's nobody really uses, like a flathead design.
There's a combustion chamber at the top with the valves. Yes. Pretty much every engine. Yeah. We know that's what we think of when we think of an engine. The valves up top.
Yes, exactly.
So this was the new stuff back then.
This was the new design. Yeah. But this is what they had learned from the Europeans with an overhead design. It's much more efficient. The main advantage is that they breathe a lot better than a flathead. Since the valves in a flathead are on the same side of the combustion chamber, you just can't flow enough air. But with an overhead design like this, you can... Your valves can be angled differently, usually like at a 45-degree angle in that neighborhood. With more airflow, more efficient, more power, baby.
These boys breathe.
Flathead not necessarily breathing very well. So anyway,
I'm flathead today.
Yeah.
But that's only because my parents left me in the crib too long.
Oh. Since this overhead conversion for the Model T made so much more power, this became very popular in dirt track racing. And near the end of 1920, the Miller Production Company officially began manufacturing their own engines, with Harry designing them, Leo refining them, and Fred crafting them. They borrowed heavily from the Peugeot race engines that they had spent the last few years working on. While they were called Miller engines in the beginning, they established a blueprint for both the design and success of the Offenhauser engines that would follow. From 1920 to 1979, each engine had the same basic layout. It utilized an integral block and head with dual overhead cams on top of a separate barrel-like aluminum crankcase. What the heck is that? Yeah. Most of these were four-cylinder engines. Larger engines commonly had four valves per cylinder within a pent roof configuration, and smaller engines typically used two valves per cylinder in a hemispheric combustion chamber. So a hemi. They got hemi heads.
Hemispherical just means like domed.
It's more domed, yeah.
And you get more compression out of that?
It just burns really efficiently.
And a pent roof is like how you would imagine like a house. Like
I believe
roof.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So, but four valves per cylinder. So yeah, these boys are breathing a lot.
And this is really early for that kind of stuff too. Like, mm-hmm. This didn't really make it into a lot of production cars until later.
This is very early stuff.
So when we're saying 1920 to 1979, this is like the overall idea of the engine, but they're not using the same blueprint all the way through, are they?
Right.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
A defining feature of most of the engines was a long stroke and small bore, which gave them torque advantages over the shorter stroke 6 and 8 cylinder engines they often competed against. They had other advantages as well. Their dual overhead cam design made them more volumetrically and thermodynamically efficient than their pushrod and flathead rivals, and the modular nature of the engines made it easy to replace parts.
Modular nature.
They're easy to work on. They're meant to be worked on.
Yeah.
The craftsmanship was second to none, and they were forgiving of abuse from both drivers and mechanics. Those familiar with the engines would often develop a sort of love affair with them. Mm. It's not all uncommon to read a mechanic or driver describing the engine's unique smell. The engines are often described as jewel-like, and a certain reverence is held for Fred as an artist. Miller engines were successful from the jump, and developing an audience with board track races across the country. So that's like those super speedways that are made of wood.
Whoa.
There used to be a couple of them in L.A.
There was one in Beverly Hills, right?
Beverly Hills and also in Mar Vista, I believe, had one as well.
So, and I just found out that Woodward Avenue in Detroit, this was a question on the Car Jeopardy video we just shot. Woodward Avenue used to be planks.
Oh, wow.
Like board
Street. Weird.
Yeah.
That's wild. A 3-liter straight 8 Miller engine found its way into the Duesenberg chassis of Jimmy Murphy at the 1921 Indy 500. Murphy easily qualified for pole position, and after the green flag was waved, he never ceded ground. The Miller-powered Duesenberg cruised to victory, and overnight, racing teams were clamoring for the Miller engines.
Dude, straight 8s.
Straight 8 is crazy. Dang,
bring back straight 8s.
3 liters is small for an 8-cylinder, too.
Yeah, it is.
A little dinky
thing probably
pistons.
Revved to the moon.
But they had long strokes, so they were like Red Bull can cylinders.
Straight 8, long stroke. Yeah, we're speaking my language now.
A fierce rivalry with Duesenberg ensued, and it would take 3 years before they could unseat the Miller engines from the podium. Duesenberg worked tirelessly to find an advantage before finally striking back in 1924 to the whiny soundtrack of a supercharger.
Whoa.
But the Miller team's ability to take existing designs and perfect them would undo Duesenberg's moment of glory the following year. The Miller team developed their own aluminum centrifugal supercharger and reclaimed victory in 1925, and the engines only improved from there on out.
So Miller's putting their engines in Duesenberg's, and Duesenberg is like, well, we want our engines and our cars to be better, so that's where this rivalry is coming from.
Okay. It was seems like one driver put, what's his name, Harry?
Murphy.
Jimmy Murphy.
Jimmy Murphy. He put the Offie in his doozy, and then doozy was like, we don't like that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
They said that.
Yeah.
In 1928, Leon Duret qualified at Indy with a speed of 122.391 miles per hour with a Miller 91.5 cubic inch supercharged straight. What? a record that stood for 9 years, 91 cubic inches.
That's crazy.
It's a little tiny boy, though.
That's 1.5 liters.
The cars were even sent to compete in Europe, where they won a number of races. Ettore Bugatti had been so impressed with what he saw, he bought the cars off Miller to learn how they were built, and the engines he built for his next racer looked surprisingly similar.
Wow. Hmm.
But perhaps the most staggering statistic of their first decade racing is that between 1922 and 1928, Miller engines powered an overwhelming 83% of the field at Indianapolis.
Wow.
By the end of the decade, the engines grew so popular they would fetch upwards of $10,000, a stunning figure in an era where a Ford could be bought for under $500.
That's sick.
And so is this before Indy was like regulated as far as engine size?
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
Run what you brung.
So nowadays, there is a very strict regulation size for engines,
uh-huh.
and there's only two Indy engine manufacturers, Chevy Ooh. And Honda.
Yeah, right now, yeah.
So this was before that, and the engines were just so good that everyone wanted to run their engines.
So $10,000 in 1928
yeah,
is equal to 180 grand.
Wow. You know what's crazy? I think about how Indy cars back then were just like an engine with a seat attached to it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're basically open air.
Yeah.
There's no roll cage or anything. Yeah. You're
true war boy stuff.
Unfortunately, Miller's dominance at Indy caused a backlash. Major manufacturers had quit in droves, and at the end of the 1920s, race officials attempted to curb the Miller's dominance and draw major manufacturers back with a rule change that banned forced induction and required the use of, quote, stock or semi-stock 366 cubic inch passenger car engines. So there you go. Now we got rules.
Now we got reggies.
Miller, of course, didn't produce passenger cars. They had been all but outright banned. It was a major setback for the team. But by this point, Harry hardly cared. He made a fortune from the business. He bought a ranch in the Santa Monica Mountains and had entered the burgeoning Hollywood scene, baby.
Hell yeah, dude. That's like moving to Dubai right now.
Harry was also uninterested in, quote, dumbing down their high-tech designs and decided that he would sell several of the company's factories to a group of investors and find other applications for the company's engines and design prowess. But 5 months later, the stock market crashed.
Well, he got out at the right time.
I know.
Sure did. I bet we could find that guy's house now, the Santa Monica Mountains.
Mm.
Take a little hike up there.
And do what?
Hang out.
Squat it,
yeah.
All we got to do is live there for 30 days
yeah.
and pay and make repairs,
We're good
and then
to
we
go.
Own that thing.
For the Miller Production Company, money continued to dwindle into the 1930s. The Great Depression meant expensive engines were out of the question for even high-end racing teams, and nationwide, people began to shift to more inexpensive midget racing for dirt and board tracks. Low engine sales were one problem, and Harry was another. He was still in a leadership role and was completely misreading the financial moment. To complicate matters, he had become difficult to work with and prone to delusions of grandeur. Rather than shift focus to inexpensive designs, he pitched ridiculous ideas like 24-cylinder marine engines and a front-wheel drive V16 passenger car.
Whoa.
When Fred
Front-wheel
drive, baby. That's insane. When Fred and Leo pushed back, Harry would say, well, that's what I want. Harry was also involved in shady financial moves to maintain his extravagant lifestyle. And in a time where the business's profit was just under $40,000 a year, Harry was paying himself a $7,500 annual salary.
Yeesh.
By 1933, tensions came to a head, and investors filed involuntary bankruptcy against Harry. Harry and the Miller Production Company were done, but Fred and Leo weren't prepared to lose what they had built, and together they bought the company at a bankruptcy auction.
Hostile takeover right there.
That would have been a stressful auction, dude.
Yeah, dude.
Bidding against other freaks who want your business?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that story of Michael Jackson buying the Beatles catalog while sitting next to, what's his name, Paul?
Really?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
He was like all smiles until it was like auction time and then just bought the entire Beatles catalog from under Paul.
Wait, Michael Jackson bought their catalog?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who owns it now?
I think the
Blanket?
I don't know. There's some big music. I thought they bought it back.
I think they bought it back. Yeah.
And that's why it's on streaming now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe Apple Music.
I think Apple bought it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not the Apple from Silicon Valley, but Apple, the record label.
Oh, really?
I don't know. This isn't a freaking entertainment business podcast.
Well, Leo and Fred were determined to get the company back into racing and set their sights on the more affordable midget racing. A plan was in place. A new design was in the works, and the company was renamed to Offenhauser Engines.
Finally.
Ooh.
Together, Fred and Leo created a 200 cubic inch four cylinder they developed from a 151 cubic inch marine engine design in 1926 that had unintentionally become a popular swap for Ford Model Ts and Model As.
Wow, that was like the LS of the day. Who put this boat engine in your Model T?
The new engine was specifically designed to allow for increases in displacement as to be a, quote, one-size-fits-all for the various amateur and semi-professional leagues across the United States, and it proved to be exceptionally popular. They were incredibly dominant on the Midget Championship Trail, a series of 100-mile contests ran primarily on one-mile dirt tracks. But it was in 1935 that Offenhauser truly began to cement its legacy. With Kelly Patillo at the Willow. With the Willow.
Racing at Willow.
With Kelly Patillo at the wheel, the team won its first Indy 500 under the Offenhauser name. And though Leo would leave the company for rival Schroeder in 1939, the company would carry on its dominant run in the Indy 500. The team won the Indy 500 a total of three times before the U.S.'s entry into World War II in December 1941, and with two going to older Miller designs. Offenhauser's efforts would be put on pause during the war, during which time they primarily produced parts for Lockheed aircraft. But in the grand scheme of things, the company was only getting started. And after the war, they would embark on a run of dominance never before seen in motorsport.
Oh,
so
baby.
This is over 20 years, well, about 20 years after they developed this engine, and it's still taking championships.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, no, this is the, I think this is the 200 one, or no.
Oh, I think this is a new design.
It's probably the same principle with an overhead cam, but they're using a big boat engine now instead of a Model T.
Yeah, they upped the displacement.
Offenhauser resumed engine manufacturing in 1946, but after the pressures of running the business for the war effort, the 58-year-old Fred was ready to retire. Fred sold his shares of the business to race car driver and riding mechanic Lou Meyer and Dale Drake, who renamed the business Meyer and Drake Engineering Corps. Drake and Meyer kept the name Offenhauser on the engines they produced, as well as on the company letterhead and signs. The official naming rights for the Offenhauser name went to Fred's nephew, Fred C. Offenhauser. Shortly after his uncle's departure, Fred C. began a consumer products company under the Offenhauser name in Culver City, California.
Hey!
This version of Offenhauser, known as Offenhauser Power and Racing Equipment, made products such as heads and intakes for hot rods and helped kickstart the aftermarket performance scene. They were also part of the first SEMA and went from 1946 to 1986, they made parts for basically every platform out there. Chevy even sent five V8s to Offenhauser ahead of their launch so they can prepare parts for it. That's sick. They had a whole catalog like Summit Racing. And they also developed a lot of stuff for Shelby. So that's cool.
So they must have been tight with Robert Peterson.
Probably.
Yeah, who started SEMA.
However, this whole confusing kind of arrangement might have spelled the end for the Offenhauser legacy, but Leo Goosen had returned to the fold earlier that year as chief engineer and was determined to carry on the company's legacy, and he and the new owners were prepared to take the company in a new direction. Thanks to the post-war economic boom, the affordable midget racing scene that had helped sustain Offenhauser was now in decline because people wanted to spend money, not save it.
Yeah, have a ton of babies.
Yeah, they decided they would instead focus on making a return to producing the sort of incredibly detailed, high-tech engines for higher-profile races that had made Miller engines so dominant in the 1920s. They started by modernizing the shop and making the first major improvements to the original Miller designs in 20 years by designing new rods and bearings. Within just a year, the renewed Offenhauser was ready to make its Indy 500 debut with Lou Moore's Blue Crown team.
So these guys were like the Mr. Beast of building engines.
Yes. The two Offie-powered cars qualified on the front row, and from the start, it was clear they were the cars to beat. Driver Bill Holland had an incredible race and extended an impressive lead on the other Offie-powered car, driven by Mari Rose, which is running in second place. Holland's lead was so safe, the team gave him a sign with the letters EZ as the race was drawing near the end, imploring him just to play it safe and secure the win. Holland backed off and allowed himself to be caught by Rose, who he believed himself to be a lap ahead of. But Rose...
I'd be so pissed.
Yeah. Rose was, in fact, on the lead lap and overtook Holland with 7 laps to go and secured the first win of what is now known as the Offie Engine's Golden Era. All told, the Offenhauser-powered car would win the Indy 500 for 18 years straight and claim dozens of championships across the country.
Wow, you think Max Verstappen is annoying. Imagine being in any engine manufacturer at this time.
Sheesh. 2 decades.
Yeah.
That's wild. So he thought he was lapping the guy, but really he was in first place?
He thought the guy behind him was a lap behind, so he's like, I'll let him catch up. He still has another lap to go, but he was incorrect.
Brutal.
But it was still an Offie. So
From 1950 to 1960, not only did an Offie win every single Indy 500, an Offie got every single podium as well.
Damn.
During the 18-year run, some years even saw every single car on the grid use an Offie.
Wow. Whoa.
In terms of dominance by an engine manufacturer, Offie is unparalleled.
Pass Gas will be right back. Commercial time.
This kind of success is all but guaranteed to inspire desperate responses from competitors. And towards the end of the 1950s, other manufacturers were seeking some way to end Offie's monopoly.
You know what? I wonder if they were, like, in good with the organizers. Because if you were an organizer and you saw this happening, you'd probably want to, like, even the playing field a little bit.
Yeah.
It seems like there's no regulation changes to kind of stop this.
Yeah, that's possible. Up until this time, Offies were primarily designed to fit front engine roadsters, but it was becoming more clear that a mid-engine layout was going to be the future as more and more manufacturers experimented with the design. Leo Goosen saw the writing on the wall and began designing an Offie for a mid-engine chassis, but the company itself would be slow to respond. Leo spent over a decade talking to mechanics and team engineers at racetracks about the ways they thought the Offie could be improved, but when he took the ideas back to Meyer, Meyer would typically respond, "If it doesn't break, don't fix it." Regardless of how advantageous the mid-engine chassis was turning out to be, they were powerless without an engine that could compete with the Offie. But all that would change when Ford got involved.
Do you think he got that saying wrong, or he was the one who invented it and then it got, like, misinterpreted?
If it doesn't break, don't fix it.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't.
Because if it ain't broke sounds way better than if it doesn't break.
Yeah, it doesn't quite roll off the tongue.
If it doesn't break, simply don't fix it.
If you don't need to repair it, why repair it to begin with?
Dummy.
In the early 1960s, at the urging of Ford chairman Hank the Deuce, our old friend, Ford invested $10 million, over $104 million today, into developing a dual overhead cam V8 for a mid-engine car to topple Offie at Indianapolis.
Man, imagine taking Ferrari on and Offie in the same decade.
Yeah. It was Ford's first involvement at Indy in 28 years, and the engineers were at a loss to where to start. And so, they bought a 255 Offie, took it apart, and set to work. In 1964, an Offie powered the last front-engine car to ever win at Indy. The next year, Ford's V8 was ready and powered a Lotus 38 to take the checkered flag, 5 minutes ahead of the nearest Offie.
Jeez.
Offie's winning streak was over. In a post-race interview, a Ford rep referred to the Offie as, quote, the old truck motor, and claimed none would be produced for the next year's Indy 500.
Dude, that's like if Arak came and just, like, started getting 200 million views and Mr. Beast was the old truck
this
of
is
YouTube.
Let me remind you, this is the audio format. A lot of people that listen to the podcast don't follow us on, maybe they do.
They do. Let's give our dear listeners some credit here. However, I had always been curious if there's listeners who don't watch not just the podcast channel, but the main channel.
Yeah.
And my sister works with one of them.
Hmm. Oh.
He's like, I love the podcast, never watched a video.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's strange.
I think it's like 35 to 50 year olds.
Well, if you don't know, Mr. Beast is a 22-year-old.
Okay.
He's 22? Isn't he like 26?
No, he's like 26 now. Just had his birthday.
26. Wow, Nolan, you were there?
Yeah. They made me hide inside the cake for 12 hours so I could win $100,000. But I got beat by a 67-year-old woman. It was kind of a beautiful moment, though.
But you got a pallet of Feastables, though.
Yeah, I did get the second place prize was a pallet of Feastables. Yeah.
A year supply of D's nuts.
It wasn't quite the end for Offie, but a change had to be made. In 1966, only 9 Offies qualified for Indy, compared to 24 Fords. But by the end of the year, they had been given a lifeline. Regulations had been changed to allow for the use of forced induction, as long as the engine was 168 cubic inches or smaller. Throughout the off-season between 66 and 67, Leo designed and tested both supercharged and turboed versions of the engines. The head gasketless Offie was well suited for forced induction, and after extensive testing, the couple settled on using turbochargers, and with driver Bobby Unser at the wheel, returned an Offie to the top of the 500.
Head less, gasketless.
That's wild.
Crazy.
So is it just like welded shut?
I don't know.
Wild.
I just read the words here.
But they got turbocharging probably because it's not as much of a parasitic loss of power.
Producer Audrey just told us that the head and
the block
are all one piece.
And then the crankcase is the only thing that gives you access to all that. So how do you get all the way up to the valves? That's nuts. You gotta have long fingers.
You gotta have real long fingers. You're like salad fingers. On
yeah.
Fingers,
dude.
That's a little millennial reference for you.
Rafflecopter.
Charlie, bit my finger.
Charlie, baby. It's blood.
Wow. Okay. So the end was more near than anyone on the team might have realized, but they went out in an incredible blaze of glory. With Offie engines leading the way, qualifying speeds at Indy in the early 70s approached 200 miles per hour. Despite its nearly 50-year-old design, the engine improved year over year. It was extremely tolerant of boost and could handle near 60 PSI for short periods during qualifying and ran over 40 PSI of boost in race trim.
That's crazy.
Good Lord.
That's over 4
son.
Bar for our European listeners.
Wow. That's
is bar
crazy.
15?
Ish.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow. This is like a beautiful engine, though. So simplistic. Wow. That's so cool. Oh, when we were at the track this weekend, Jerry was there to drive the Civic. But Eddie had brought low Subaru to the track as well. So Jerry's like, all right, screw it. I'll take this out, see what we can do. He goes out for like 2 laps, and we see him coming around, and we're like, huh, he's going, something's up. Uh-oh. And he's coming down the straight and then immediately starts slowing down, and like orange big flames are like coming out of the exhaust.
What?
And we had to like, he couldn't get the car started. This is on the main straight at Willow, or streets of Willow. Luckily, it was right near the pit exit, so he, like, puts the car in neutral and just, like, coasts backward. It was already a yellow flag anyway for another car that had spun. So he's, like, slowly just, like, coasting back down the entrance, and we had to, like, push the car back to the pit area. And the blow-off valve blew off
Whoa.
The intake.
Wow.
Yeah. We don't know why, but
too much boost.
Happened. The boost, yeah. So speaking of boost, in one particular testing session with the engine on a stand, designers intentionally fixed the wastegate shut and revved the engine to 10,200 RPM and held it there to, quote, just to see what would happen.
Poor man's turbo.
During the test, the dyno indicated the engine was producing a little over 1,400 horsepower.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
The engineers backed it off after 90 seconds. And in an interview with one of the engineers years later about the test, he simply stated he didn't think it was the engine's max potential and said, quote, I don't know how long it could have ran that way.
God dang.
And this is a 168 cubic inches or smaller, right?
Yeah.
That's
it's
nuts.
Tiny.
Yeah.
During Offie's final golden era, its small 159 cubic inch four cylinders put out 1,200 horsepower in race trim.
That's
they took the
vendor,
yeah. They took the victory at Indy from 1972 to 76, and took the checkered flag at 13 other championship races. During this time, an Offie-powered McLaren M16C set an Offie all-time speed record of 199.071 miles per hour. So that's
Sick.
An average speed around the track.
Wow.
Leo Goosen's death in 1974 and regulation changes brought on by the gas crisis. Wah. Ultimately, saying that about the gas crisis, not Leo Goosen, ultimately spelled the end of the Offie. New rules mandated that boosts be limited to just 25 PSI and drastically reduced the size of fuel tanks. The rich running offies encountered a lot of problems running lean at high RPM, and the engines rapidly became uncompetitive. Ford V8 Cosworth engines began taking motorsport by storm in the 1970s, and offie's problems were compounded by a huge loss in revenue to the Ford engine. The last offie-powered cars ran the Indy 500 in 1980. In 1981, after a lone offie was disqualified during qualifying, an offie missed the starting grid at Indy for the first time in 46 years.
Wow.
It was also the first year since 1929 that a four-cylinder didn't compete.
Wow. So even, I mean, the DFV, what they're talking about, the Ford V8, mm-hmm. that was so dominant forever, I didn't realize that was in retaliation to the offie. Hmm. And that's double the cylinders. That's crazy.
It's wild, dude. That's what boosts can do, baby. Harry Miller, Fred Offenhauser, and Leo Goosen created nothing short of a masterpiece. They refined a design from the 1910s and created an engine so close to perfect, it dominated American racing with few changes for five decades. Each man is responsible not only for the existence of the legendary Offenhauser engines, but the leadership of the three companies that manufactured them and continued their legacy. The Offenhauser legacy is unrivaled in motorsport and carries on in classic racing clubs nationwide. The aftermarket brand born of the same name lives on in the El Serrano neighborhood of Los Angeles.
El Serrano, that's where my sister lives.
Hey. And those who worked on and raced the jewel-like engines will never forget them. I got to get my hands on one of these offies.
Give me one of them offies.
Let me get
one. Nolan, if you want one, this one sold for $60,000.
Oh, baby. That's a little rich for my blood. that was a great story.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. Man. I always wanted to know the story of offie. I'm glad we did
it. Sure. I think I know a guy with an offie engine. I'm going to go talk to him
about it. We should put that in our PC Cruiser.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right, Joe, I think we got some listener mail.
We got some listener mail from, oh no, he's an anti-wink wink guy.
Okay, well,
I can't read this. Max, you read it.
Hello. Nolan should get a pinup style tattoo of his 52 Chrysler Imperial. It's the perfect first ink for him. Also, love the show and pretty much all things donut. Thanks, Kenny, anti-wink wink nationalist.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. He's probably from Minnesota. That's why.
That's probably it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have been thinking about tattoos a lot lately.
Yeah.
We know a lot of very talented tattoo artists.
That's right.
Kat Von D.
No. Yeah. We know Kyle and Evan over there at Oxford Circle Tattoo.
Kyle's done a bunch of Post Malone's face tattoos.
Yeah.
In fact,
he's incredibly talented. Every time I see him, he's like, all right, Nolan, when are we doing it? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't have a good idea yet. And I still don't have a good idea.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the Imperial.
I mean, the reality of it,
the Imperial.
The best tattoos are the ones you don't really think about. You just walk
I've
in.
I've heard that, but still, your first one. What was your first one?
It's a cattle skull with two revolvers, and everyone thinks it's a crab.
Oh. Did you think about it when you got it?
I didn't think people were going to think it was a crab.
Okay. What about you, Max? I know you got some tats.
Yeah, my first one was. It's a series of pictures. The first one is an eyeball, and then a donut, and then a carrot, and then the letter all. And if you read it all out, it says, I don't care at all. I got that on my thigh.
Nice.
You know what?
Eyeballs, dude, I had a design I drew when I was a freshman in college because my friends had just got tattoos. And I was like, I should get one. It was an eyeball in the style of like, this is like very inspired by the Neversoft logo.
Oh, yeah.
So an eyeball, but with like tentacles coming out of it. I'm really, really glad I did not get followed through on that.
Oh, that's cool.
That'd have been sick.
It'd be kind of sick.
You know what my next tattoo is going to be?
What?
I already picked it out. It's going to be a 92 Skylark.
You're going to get that on your neck?
No. No.
Your neck tattoo?
Next tattoo. Sorry, yeah, I'm stuffed up.
It's called hoodie hard, isn't it? Where you get a neck tattoo and wrist tattoo. So it look, when you're wearing a hoodie, people assume that you're all... That's what the kids are calling it.
That's the opposite of what I was going for when I was 18, because my parents were like... Get it so you can cover it up with the long sleeve shirt. So
I think I'm just gonna keep going no tattoos for now and just see
raw dogging it.
That's cool. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Flesh core.
Yeah, I'm flesh core. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. Thank you so much, Max, for being
here. Thanks, Max.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Joe, I love you.
I love you too.
All right.
I love also love Max.
I love you guys.
I love everyone behind the scenes.
Yeah, we got Audrey Holden, Nick Giamuso, Gavin Kinzel.
And Audrey wrote the script this week, so we don't have to name a writer. She's amazing.
Thank you guys for listening. If you'd like to send us an email, hit us up at passgas@donutmedia.com and sign it with your name. Goodbye.